Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jo. And this is podcast 7A from series 3. Last podcast, 6A, we talked about markets. And we could have said more, or maybe we said too much. To tell you the truth, I both loved and hated that podcast. I felt like a dunce during it because there was so much about markets I didn't know. But the upside is it's really made me think. I'm in the process of reading a book called The Infinite Desire for Growth by Daniel Cohen as a result. Now, this week's podcast is an aid podcast. So we're going to talk about the social work journey. And in this case, we're going to talk about safeguarding. I will feel myself to be on a lot more solid ground here. Although thinking about the concept of safeguarding and who it's for and why it's undertaken is fairly tricky, I think. We could have talked about this at any time, but I think it does deserve an episode in itself.
Yes. And as always, please do let us know what you think. You can contact us by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes or on our Facebook page, Helpful Social Work Podcast. And I had a conversation this week, actually, with someone who listens to our podcasts while walking their dog and was pleased that they were the right sort of length for a dog walk.
Excellent.
So who knew that we were providing such a service?
Now, why did we choose this topic, Jerry?
We can't really talk about social work without talking about safeguarding. And actually, some people who probably are slightly further away from social work tend to think of this as being social work, child protection or protecting adults, protecting vulnerable people. And it's certainly one of the areas that's most scrutinised. It's what tends to get into the media and tends to be publicly talked about, even though it's far from being all that social work does. And in a way, it ought to be the least thing that we do. If we did everything else, I would hope that there would be much less safeguarding. If we did all the preventative work and if we did all the empowering work and the social justice work, there would be less need. But I think there always would be some need to protect and safeguard people.
I think it's fundamental, isn't it? If we have an agreed set of standards for how people should be treated and be able to live, in my case, it's always the Human Rights Act is what I go to, then we also need a way to tackle what happens if they're not treated well or able to live within society safely or get their basic needs met.
Yeah, it is part of our thinking all the time, isn't it, in any domain of social work around how do we ensure that people live lives that are free of abuse and neglect. And we do have loads and loads and loads of process around this, and I think that's not so much what we're going to talk about today. We're going to think about why are we doing this and what does it mean to do it well.
But we have those two big acts, don't we? We've got the Care Act and the Children's Act, both of which are setting out standards, I guess, for adults and children around how they can be protected from abuse and neglect and how we should respond.
Yes, and what's really amazing to think in this country, in England, is that the Care Act 2014 was the first time that adult safeguarding was put into law. Up till then, it was policy. So protection from abuse and neglect only came in to law then. And the law then now specifically says one of the principles of all we do to promote well-being is to help people to be protected from abuse and neglect. And also there is a safeguarding section which says that if there's an adult who is experiencing abuse or neglect and is not able to act against it themselves, protect themselves against it, then we have a duty in a local authority to inquire into what's happening. And there's lots and lots of guidance that then sits behind it. So it kind of came into the same sort of on the same basis as the children's protection already was.
Yeah, and the Children Act's been there since 1984, and before then there were other acts, actually. The acts really have become increasingly strengthened, particularly since the post-war period, with the death of a young boy who contributed to the changing and shaping of that act. And that's one of the things I think is really important for us to acknowledge. Every child death has contributed to the growing body of legislation and made the Children's Act what it is today. It's not something that came from nowhere. It's been shaped by children's experiences. And I always think that that's kind of the debt that we owe to these children, is that we actually always hold in mind that there have been terrible things that have happened to children and continue to happen to children and to adults as well, that shape the legislation and the policy and our responses.
Yes, it might be a good place to start actually thinking about the way in which safeguarding has changed. I mean, the first thing, the kind of fundamental thing to say from the adults world, is that we have gone from talking about adult protection in England to talking about adult safeguarding. Mm. And that's a really interesting shift in language, because the root of the word to protect is to kind of stand in front of someone like a shield, whereas the root of safeguarding is around safe, which is linked to salvus, which is healthy. So we're not standing in front of people, we are empowering them to be healthy. So I think there's a really fundamental shift, and the evidence and the writing about how we support adults shows this really clearly, that we've been asked by adults themselves to not think of them as vulnerable and needing lots of protection, but to think of them as citizens wanting to live full lives, and what are the barriers and what are the potential harms around them, and how can we work with them to keep themselves safe and to be in a context of safety.
Mm. It's this idea, isn't it, of the state providing that basic assistance, like a social protection system, you know, systems of interventions and programs, social assistance that are provided by the government and civil society, you know, to ensure welfare and protection, in this case, of all members of that society. And that, as you say, that we don't take rights away from people because they need more support, but that we ensure that they can live and participate as fully as possible.
Yes.
I think that's a bit more tricky sometimes in children's services, for us to hold that idea in mind of people, of them being able to live kind of that fully independent life, because children are in the context of a family. And so they're in the context of adult care. We perhaps think of protecting children and even stray into the idea of rescuing children, both of which are not helpful.
Yes, I think the language thing is really important there, and it is different for children and for adults. And actually, some commentators, I think, argue that for teenagers, we should be thinking more about protection than we do. We sometimes think that people are more adult and more capable and less kind of open to risk than they actually are.
Well, certainly the child sexual exploitation developments have been all about that idea that, no, you know, I mean, you know, in the 80s we might have said that someone was a child prostitute, whereas today we would say, no, they're a child who's being exploited. Yeah. They're not choosing that profession, which is what we were kind of employing, that there was free will there once they became an adolescent.
I think with children and adults, one of the things we have to be really careful of in safeguarding in our language and in our practice is the potential for victim blaming. Mm. If we want to, on the one hand, empower people to stay safe and live healthy lives themselves, we also need to recognise that some people face barriers to that, and that's not a personal criticism of them.
Exactly.
So, you know, adults didn't want to be called vulnerable adults because it implied that the reason that people would potentially harm them was because of something wrong with them.
Yeah.
Not because there were people out there who will harm people. Mm. So we do have to be really careful about when we're looking at people in context and understanding what the factors are associated with the people and what the factors associated with the context, that it's done to be helpful and not to blame.
Mm. And also, I mean, I think in our past, different times, we've been guilty as societies of using protection as a way to erode or negate human rights. I think this is something that particularly used to happen in the field of disability, where if people had a disability, then there were certain things that it was automatically presumed that they didn't have a right to. And some of those things included a healthy, active sex life, the chance to live independently, the chance to work independently, all those types of things. And so I do think we need to start with the idea of safeguarding as safeguarding human rights. These are the things that we are all entitled to as members of our society.
And our understanding of what constitutes harm and abuse does change as well, doesn't it? What we think we're safeguarding people from has changed over time. And some of the things that we might have thought we needed to protect people from, we realise now we shouldn't have been interfering there. And some things we hadn't appreciated were abuse or neglect that we now recognise are. So we constantly have to keep up to date with evidence. I'm thinking about things like you just said, you know, we used to protect people with a learning disability safe from sexual relationships. We shouldn't have been doing that. We also didn't protect teenagers from exploitation because we thought that that might be a choice. There's exactly. New kinds of awareness of how people can be harmed that we're recognizing, like modern slavery, like coercive control and cuckooing, for example. That's a very recent thing that's being written about, although I doubt it's a recent thing that's been happening to people, where someone will come and essentially inhabit someone's space, exploit them, you know, either somebody who maybe takes drugs or somebody maybe has a mental health problem or a disability and can't push the person out. So we have to keep kind of revising our understanding not only of what safeguarding means but also what we're safeguarding people from.
Yes. And the other thing, of course, is contextual safeguarding in children's services, which offers a challenge around how we perceive risk and safety in adolescence and how we place these behaviours into an environmental context. And I think one of the really interesting things they do there is that they make environmental maps to find out where young people feel safe and where they feel at risk. Mm-hmm. And they try to address the risks in the environment as well as the risk that the individual might be facing. And one of the really interesting things there that we realize is that some environments that people are trying to navigate and negotiate are really quite dangerous. And if we just keep dealing with it on an individual basis, we just keep moving individual after individual after individual away from that environment instead of saying, actually, it's the environment that needs to be addressed here. And if we're proactive about managing that, we'll keep a whole heap of people safer and more able to be independent and live well.
I'm partway through reading Child Protection, a Social Model, which just came out this year by Bridget Featherstone and Anna Gupta and Kate Morris and Sue White. There you go. I did remember everyone.
Well done.
And it's great because it's putting the desire to protect children and the imperative to protect children into a social model, into a social context, into looking at what are the barriers, personal and cultural and structural, to us, to people being able to parent or protect their children and children being able to be protected. And it's really illuminating. And it also obviously talks very much about the way that what were seen as or could be seen as sorrows, as troubles, as difficulties that people face become kind of pathologized and punished rather than us helping people to navigate those and to overcome them. So there is a real tension there, isn't there, between keeping people safe and recognizing the difficulties that people who should care for them might experience in doing that.
And also just what the journey of life. And then I've got a lovely quote here, actually, from Sue White again. So it must be a Sue White podcast, hey? where she says parenting capacity is not seen as fixed, but is undergoing constant change dependent on the circumstances facing parents and their children at any given moment in time. Parenting capacity is context driven and is dependent on distal factors such as the socioeconomic surroundings of the family, housing, culture, societal values, as well as more proximal family skills and relationships. And I think it's really good for us to remember that not only is safeguarding not all about focusing on an individual in a deficit model, which it never should be, but that also the need for support and help or challenge fluctuates from time to time. And people have good days and bad days. We all do. And we need to be able to acknowledge that much more. We tend to take a photograph of somebody in this assessment work we do, and it's almost like we freeze them in amber, and that's where they're stuck forever. That's the only story they're allowed to tell, instead of seeing their story, that part of their story, as part of their ongoing journey. And I do think we struggle in safeguarding with allowing people to be more than their sorrows, more than their struggles.
So that's sort of some of the philosophy that, in terms of the practice of how we go about doing this, it's probably worth us kind of talking through what we actually do as social workers when we have somebody say it's safeguarding, which is a kind of a typical way that these things get introduced. It's safeguarding, this person's at risk, do something. And certainly for the adults safeguarding world, one of the things that's been happening for the last few years is that we've been trying really hard to start with outcomes, to start with understanding what the person themselves wants to get out of safeguarding, where they want to end up, and to involve them at the very beginning and be saying, hey, this is what we hear is going on. What's it like for you? Where do you want to be? And I think if you start with where you want to get to, then you're more likely to follow the right path to it. I'd be interested in your take on how that looks in children's services.
I think that's really interesting. As you were saying that, I was just thinking about that, Jerry. I think, first of all, in early help, which is when professionals are highlighting to us that people need more support to parent their children well than can be offered universally, just in the commons, you know, in the services everyone gets, I think there's much more of an emphasis on talking to the family, talking to the child, saying, what is it you would hope to get from this service? How can we be helpful? All of that type of conversation. However, I think that once it gets pushed into safeguarding, where we decide that what needs to happen is what we call a Section 47 investigation. In other words, we need to go out under the Children's Act to understand whether this child is at risk of significant harm. So significant harm is a threshold we're looking at there. Then I think there's much less starting from what people want, and much more starting from what does our expertise and experience tell us about the likelihood that this child is suffering or has suffered significant harm. And so I think there's a really quite a different emphasis. Now, I think that there's lots and lots of work being done nationally to try and change that dialogue. So, for instance, in Hertfordshire, I know, and the work that Sue Williams is doing at the moment in other local authorities is all about trying to find a way to have helpful dialogues with children and families, even in the context of, you know, significant harm. And certainly Signs of Safety would say the same thing, wouldn't it? It would say that what we need to do is start by working in collaboration with the parents to see if there is any way that they can change their circumstances with our support rather than this kind of assessing and intervening approach. I still think we've got a long way to go, is what I would say. Porter's just come out about babies being brought into care. Just about newborn babies being brought into care, which says that actually we're seeing some of the highest rates now of newborn babies coming into care. And we know that there's a steady increase in looked after children. So there's something, there seems to be tension between the conversations that people are having and the things that they might want to do, and then what's actually happening in practice, where perhaps there's an impact around resources and how families can be supported that may be pushing people into using child protection and also bringing children into care as a response to the situations children are found in.
Yeah.
And that's tricky because, you know, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child states clearly that they're convinced that the family is the fundamental group of society and the natural environment for the growth and well-being of all their members, and particularly children. And so it should be afforded the necessary protection and assistance. And I think it's about how do we help the family system and experience as it kind of moves across the life cycle and kind of decrease vulnerability and heighten resilience in those family systems. And as you say, in the communities as well, because when times are tough in terms of resources and in terms of communities, you know, when everyone feels more stressed and pressed, people are less generous, aren't they? You're less generous with your time. You're less generous with your resources. You tend to kind of husband everything. And that can leave people who are experiencing difficulties even more exposed.
Yes, I think the resource needed goes hand in hand with the need for information about what's a helpful intervention, what's a helpful step into someone's life to try to safeguard them. And that information is improving, but it's still really contested, and it's not always used in a balanced way. You can find evidence to act swiftly, you can find evidence to act more slowly, you can find evidence to keep things in one way or in another way, as you know.
Yes.
And it's going to have to be individual for each situation, but that means that you need to be able to look at what's happening, find good information and evidence to support a best guess of the best way to enable safety in that situation, and then have the resource to do something unique for that particular circumstance. And the other thing I think you do need, we were talking about the timeliness, is the opportunity and ability to keep revisiting things, because we do some very decisive things that can't be undone, or very difficult to undo.
Or that we don't try to undo, Jerry. I think that's what that reminds me of, is sometimes we forget to revisit things as much as we should. And we do need to keep going back and looking at people's circumstances and situations, and see that if there's been any change, if there's a continuation of somebody's ability to thrive or not.
Some of the positive things that I've seen in services around this country are, so in children's services, good edge of care services, you know, the services where people are really worried that a family might not be able to stay together, and there's lots and lots of support put in on the spot rather than lots of checking. So a shift from kind of scrutiny to hands-on help. Also some really good work around bringing adults and children's services together to look at family safeguarding and bring in understanding of the difficulties that the adults face to help understand how to support the children. And in adult services, you know, kind of taken from children's, we've done more family group conferencing and looking at how the whole family in the network and the community can keep people safe. And as I said, the big thing in adults is focusing on outcomes and trying to understand, is this person happier than they were? What does that mean to them? Rather than kind of always going for safety.
Yeah.
But I think that is easier with adults than children, isn't it?
Well, you'd see the child from the terms we talk about, you know, that what's the impact on the child of what we're doing, or what's the outcome for this child? Is this child meeting their developmental milestones? You know, are they able to attend school and do the things that they would want to do socially? Are they able to feel as if they can talk to adults about their issues? You know, do they feel they belong somewhere? What kind of identity do they have? And can they do all the jobs that a child needs to do to continue to grow and thrive and turn into, I guess. And the other thing we're always thinking about is the emerging adult. How are we going to help this child grow up to be an adult who can have a safe, choice-filled life? Mm. And I think that's always what we're aiming for whenever we work with any child or family, is to get to a stage where that young person develops into an adult who has choice and safety and belonging.
Yeah. So it's really contested, isn't it? Because essentially safeguarding is stepping into the realm of personal relationships mm-hmm. and saying that they're not working and there's harm and trying to change them. And that's really kind of intimate interference in people's day-to-day lives. And I do think that there's ethical justification for it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be working in social work, probably. Mm. But we do need to always be really clear about what our purpose is, and not just who we're most focused on, but the impact on the other people around. And I think the more we can use evidence to help us navigate through, the better. But it's going to come down to how well we can get to know the people in the situation and understand the different factors that are impacting on them. And it's going to come down to judgment on what level of impact there is and what might alleviate it. Certainly in children's services, there's lots of power to step in and change what's happening. In adult services, it's different because an adult is a full citizen and you can't do anything. People can make decisions to stay in harmful situations. Yes.
I think you're talking about the issue of contested rights, aren't you? Yeah. The right of the mother and father to parent child, the right of the child to be offered safe, predictable, warm, nurturing care, the right of a citizen to have a private life. And when is it okay for someone to safeguard us against our own will? And these are all things that you're having to balance up all the time as a social worker in this field. And I think that we need to constantly consider them. You know, we're always on someone else's ground, and we should tread lightly and respectfully and be curious all the time about what good looks like for them.
These judgments about safeguarding are always going to be judgments rather than absolutes about this is definitely 100% going to work or 100% going to have this impact or this outcome. Mm. So that means that we have to be really confident as a profession that we understand what a good judgment looks like regardless of the outcome, and be also really proactive in monitoring what outcomes are so that we can change and review and adjust if we need to. And when, unfortunately, sometimes things do good decisions do lead to poor outcomes, I think it's really important that we improve public understanding of the reasons for that. Doesn't necessarily mean that there was poor safeguarding practice.
A good scrutiny of why you're doing what you're doing in terms of your written record, and also obviously checking decision making in conferences and in supervision is really helpful to watch some of those localized traps that you can fall into.
Yes, I think that's the final big piece of the picture, isn't it? It's the support, it's the backup and help with our decisions and the oversight of our thinking and the checking. And that is really helpful to do within the profession. So to talk to colleagues, to have a supervisor, to share learning across different places so you don't fall into really localized practice. And it's also really useful to do that with other agencies. And I think it's one of the most positive things about safeguarding in the last while has been the real development of multi-agency work, and that not just being, oh, we have to work together, but people have really thrived working together.
And I think the other thing is, you know, we've, you know, children certainly and adults, as you say, you talked about cuckooing, people harm people deliberately, and we have to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to talk about that and face up to that, because I think that nobody wants anything distasteful to occur to other people, particularly when it involves suffering and cruelty. Mm. And I think that one of the things for social workers in safeguarding is that you will see that wide range of human behaviour, and you have to be able to accept it. We have to be able to talk about that and explore that and understand that, don't you? And keep it in your mind.
And manage the impact of that on us so that we neither run from it or get used to it. So I just wanted to finish really by thinking about the positive endeavour that safeguarding is.
Yep. You
know, if people could all be safe and free from harm, that would be wonderful. And we're not there. So it's great that there are social workers who will go and meet with people and find out what's happening and strive to change things for them.
Yep.
And it's fraught with difficulty, and there's always going to be uncertainty and a lot of contentious issues, but it's really worthwhile.
I always hold the tension in my head about the fact that you can do harm when you prevent harm. And so Not to make myself scared of acting, because I'm not scared of acting, but to make myself look as widely as I can and listen as hard as I can and be as curious as I can and never, ever just do things without looking at evidence and without looking at support from other agencies and those kind of things. I think it's a field where you need to use all the scaffolding that's offered to you.
Mm.
And you need to hold that uncertainty always and go forward with that in the best way that you can.